Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. And today we're talking with Hamish Cameron, the author of The Sprawl, a powered by the apocalypse cyberpunk game that is currently on Kickstarter. Thank you for joining us, Hamish.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me.
So you have a cyberpunk game, and the first question that came to my mind is, why a cyberpunk game?
I find cyberpunk a really fascinating genre for three reasons, two of which are about the genre itself and one of which is kind of personal. I think all sci-fi speaks to the society that we're in. All good sci-fi speaks to the society that we're in almost more than it speaks to the future. So the first reason that I really like cyberpunk is the kind of social question. Like, what does it mean when corporations are exerting a ridiculous amount of control over people's lives? And that, I think, is a really relevant question to, like, the world today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have corporations with legal rights of people and militarized police defending corporate interests. And, I mean, Monsanto owns Blackwater. So, hello, cyberpunk present.
Yeah.
The second thing is the kind of personal question about what it means to interface yourself with a machine, which cyberpunk takes to a really, like, graphic level almost. And I try and bring that out in the game by asking a couple of questions of all the players when they install cyberware, and everybody gets cyberware in the game. And the first question is, why did you decide to get part of your body cut out and replaced with metal and chrome? And
okay.
The second question is, how did you afford to have somebody do that? And that, I find, I've never read a cyberpunk game where that was explicitly on the table. The fact that you have a cyber arm, you cut off your arm, or something happened to your arm, something traumatic, presumably. Mm-hmm. Or you have a cyber eye, like somebody had to dig out your eyes and replace it with artificial thing. That's a pretty intense thing to think about. And so I try and, I don't know, foreground that, I guess, in the character generation process. Mm-hmm. And I find those questions kind of interesting as well. The third thing is nostalgia. That one of the very first games that I started playing a lot was Shadowrun, and I kind of always wanted to get back into playing that, but could never really bring myself to, you know, take the time to read the latest rule edition and introduce people to the game and then play the game, which is, I mean, it's fun, and I had a great time playing it mm-hmm. as a teenager. But the thought of sitting down for 4 hours to play a couple of combats now, I'm too busy for that.
Awesome.
Right, so instead of going back and relearning Shadowrun, whatever edition, 5th edition now, 6th edition, you instead decided to take the Herculean undertaking of making your own game.
It's true, yeah. Well, I mean, I also like designing games. So designing it was fun. So that was a kind of, lonely fun time, I guess.
Right.
Where I just got to muck around with things, see if they'd work, and then playtest them. And I like that process of introducing a game to people and then seeing what they think is wrong with it mm-hmm. and what questions they ask with it of it. And if I can defend it to them, if I can come up with a reason why I've done something the way I've done it, or if I can't, and I'm like, oh, no, that's a really good point. I didn't think of that. Why do I do that? That's mm-hmm. a sort of unquestioned assumption that I've made about something. I should revise that. And I really like that process as well. So it's not just like, okay, I want to play Shadowrun.
Right.
I have to. All right. Here comes 100 hours of work.
Yeah. This has been in beta testing for a long time, too, hey?
About 3 years, yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah, the very first Big Bad Con, which is a convention in Oakland, I went to Endgame Oakland afterwards and found a secondhand hardcover edition of the first edition of Shadowrun. I was like,
cool.
Oh, sweet. Because I only had a soft cover back in the day, and now the spine of it is held together with masking tape because
mm-hmm.
I played it so much. And I was looking through it, and I was getting all nostalgic, and I'd just sort of been playing Dungeon World a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, you know, this would work pretty well with Dungeon World or with an Apocalypse World engine.
Well, I guess leads me to the question I have to ask. Since Shadowrun has magic and Dungeon World has magic, did you at first try to make sort of a Shadowrun analogy that had magic and the races, or did you just cut all that out and go straight to cyberpunk?
In the very first iterations I did, I had two playbooks, one called the Caller and one called the Slinger, I think, that may see the light of day in a Kickstarter stretch goal or something. We'll see how it goes. Mm-hmm. But I quickly realized that the thing that I liked about Shadowrun was the cyberpunk and not the magic. Because I just didn't really care about Astral Space. I'd never played a mage. I cared about having a shotgun and being a badass dude with cyberware and shooting people and doing missions and corporations and that stuff. That's the stuff I cared about as a teenager.
That's the best part.
That's what I thought. I played Cyberpunk 2020 a couple of times, but never really. That wasn't really something our group did. I feel like if I'd been introduced to that first, then my nostalgia would be for Cyberpunk 2020. I mean, I came to that and I read through that book later, but that's more of an Anderson almost than Shadowrun in some way. Shadowrun is like the inspirational thing that I love, but not necessarily the thing that it's based on more.
Okay, well, you're talking a lot about nostalgia. Does this game owe more to the books and movies of the 80s and 90s or to the state of the internet and computers today?
That's a question that I leave up to the individual table. I like the idea of going into like a CD-backed alley and plugging your head physically into like a wall socket of a bank ATM or something to hack into it. I like that image.
Yeah.
And that tends to be the way that I think about it and the way I run games. But there's nothing in the rules that says you have to do that, and you could totally do it as all wireless computing and hacking, like in, I think, the current editions of Shadowrun now do that.
Right.
It's just, I like that real 80s cyberpunk Gibson feel. And Gibson acknowledges that he didn't really know anything about computers. And I'm not a computer scientist, so I feel like the more I tried to make it realistic, the more I just end up putting body parts in my mouth and it would just be a mess.
Right.
So if I just kind of abstract it back and think about the images and the kind of VR world, like in the Johnny Mnemonic movie, that kind of thing, and just, yeah. And it's more physical as well. If you're plugging yourself into things, it kind of foregrounds the human-machine interface a little bit more.
Right. But if people want to have Google Glass, they can do that as well.
Oh, totally. And I definitely incorporate some of that kind of stuff into my games. It's kind of, when I run it, it's kind of a weird melange of the two. And I think it works fine like that.
Well, it sounds like the setting's pretty open. How would you describe the default setting to somebody? What is the sprawl?
In the introduction, I describe it as the contemporary world turned up to 11. So the corporations have more power. The rich people are richer. The poor people are poorer. Everything is more violent, more excessive. So any kind of setting in which you have all of those things and you have corporations as major players that control everything pretty much, you could use the sprawl for it. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that Apocalypse World, the system, the way the moves are constructed, the GM moves and the player moves, kind of gives you a lot of setting information. And the setting information that the sprawl gives you is that it's corporate controlled and it's dark and it's gritty. And I mean, you play to find out what happens, I guess.
Yeah.
I like games where the players control a lot of the setting. That's one of the things that I really like out of play, and both as a GM and as a player. I like it when I can devolve some of that setting agency onto the players.
Mm-hmm.
And when I can have the power totally within the rules as the GM to make up stuff as well. I like some settings, but I don't often buy settings. So I'm usually more interested in the tone that the rules convey or the that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, actually, I was just going to comment that that's one of the sections of the book that I thought was really interesting, is how the corporations are built together between the players and the game master. And I thought it was very kind of Fate-esque and it was a real thing right up Apocalypse World's alley. So it was a really nice aspect of the game that I thought was cool.
Yeah, and even before Apocalypse World came out, that was something that I really liked. The idea of getting players to create things in the world as kind of a buy-in. Because people are going to be way more invested in the setting if they've made part of it than if it's just like, okay, so the GM made up the story and I'm just here to kill some orcs, that kind of thing.
Right.
Very cool.
So the sprawl is based on the Apocalypse World engine by Vincent Baker, and kind of surprised that you said it was inspired by Dungeon World. So the big question for me in all this was, why use the Apocalypse World system for the cyberpunk game?
Yeah, so it started, as I said, I was thinking about Dungeon World, thinking about Shadowrun. But along the way, the more I worked on it and the more I played it, the more I realized that Dungeon World wasn't a good basis in the Apocalypse World, the more I drew from Apocalypse World. The things I really like about Apocalypse World are the play-to-find-out thing, the agenda, the way that you are explicitly told to be fans of your characters, of the player's characters, and that's something that I always tried to do in my gaming anyway, and I feel like that's one of the reasons that people come back to my games more often than not, is because I see my job as the GM to make you guys awesome. And then I want to see what awesome things you guys do. And then it's fun for me and it's fun for you, because I don't want to come along and just have a story and I'm running you through my story. That isn't very exciting for me. I can just, you know, write it or imagine it and then, okay, now I'm going to go have a coffee. So I like that part of Apocalypse World.
Hmm.
The other thing that I really like is the way that it's low prep. And I have a section in the game, in the sprawl, called Cyberpunk Dreaming, where I talk about, basically, I do prep by thinking cyberpunk things. And this is not new to my game. This is a thing that people do for Apocalypse World and other games as well, where they just, you just think of all the color, and so you have all of that in your head. And then when you come to the table, you can buff forth Apocalyptica, as Apocalypse World says, or I forget what my term for it is.
Oh, I was going to ask if you had one for the sprawl.
It's something like, it's chrome everything, bathe it in neon, and smear it in dirt.
Oh, yeah, I saw that line. I love that.
Yeah, because that for me is, like, cyberpunk in a lot of ways is about image. I mean, there is substance to it as well, but that image layer is really important. And whether it tells you something about what's underneath or hides what's underneath, that's a really interesting facet of the genre as well for me.
Mm-hmm. Right, what is it? Yeah, cyberpunk is, for me too, is kind of style over substance.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, and even the style over substance, but yet not. That's actually kind of an explicit lie, because it really is about the substance, but the style tells you about the substance as well. Mm-hmm. And I really like that kind of dichotomy.
Right. So using the Apocalypse World kind of as a base starting point, or drawing on it for inspiration, what have you done to the system so that it really supports the cyberpunk genre and setting?
First of all, I would say that it does a particular kind of cyberpunk, and that's a mission-based cyberpunk, as probably most familiar to gamers through role-playing games like Shadowrun and Cyberpunk 2020. And all of the other cyberpunk games that are around. It doesn't try and do like a broad open world interpersonal thing like a lot of Gibson's works are directly about. But it tries to get at that layer of the jobs that people talk about in Gibson's work.
Hmm.
So one of the things that makes the sprawl particularly unique is the mission structure that I have, where there are explicit kind of phases to the game. You have a legwork phase where you're conducting legwork to get things, to find out information and prepare for the mission and plan for the mission.
Right.
And there's a clock that counts down to how much the corporations know about what your plans are. And if that countdown clock gets to zero, then they know everything. They know who you are and when you're coming and all that. And that affects the mission clock, which is the second part, the mission phase, or the action phase, sorry, which is when you're actually doing the job. And the countdown clock in that phase tells you how the response of the target facility or corporation or person, whatever you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's during play. And then it's kind of bracketed by the get the job move and the get paid move, which take all of those classic cyberpunk mission tropes, like do you know who the employer is? Like they're just an anonymous Mr. Johnson. Or are you going to get screwed over at the end? Is it all an ambush or a setup? And puts those decisions in the hands of the players.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking at the get the job move, at least from the beta. And yeah, the options you can choose from are the employer provides useful information, the employer provides useful assets, the job pays well, the meeting doesn't attract attention, and the employer is identifiable.
Which of these do you choose?
Yeah, exactly. You want them all, but you can only pick one.
Yeah, I really love that about Apocalypse World, the way the moves are structured in that way. It's like, okay, so here's three bad choices. Which one do you want to happen, or which one do you not want to happen?
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Both as a player and as a GM. I love seeing the players' faces when I present them with this horrible choice they have to make, and I love being a player on the receiving end of that choice as well. Yeah,
I think the idea of like people getting screwed over is so much a part of just the cyberpunk setting and fiction that people are expecting it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine players being... I can imagine them enjoying it because that's what they signed up for. And right. Then maybe the fact that yeah, the your terminology and the fact that it is cyberpunk enables like a newer MC to be able to get the hang of it.
I think putting some of that choice in the player's hands helps the MC as well. Like if they are deciding, oh yeah, I'm not going to choose that. This was a setup this time. The MC doesn't have to, okay, there was a setup last time. Should it be a setup this time? That kind of hard decision behind the scenes of are they overplaying the setup ambush thing? If you put it in the player's hands, well, do you think you guys have been set up enough?
Yeah.
Hey, right, here you go. This one's set up. You chose it. You just have to be ready as the MC with some ideas about how that could happen.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Great, you give that choice to the players, and they choose the setup when you weren't anticipating it, and then you have to scramble to figure out how that happens.
Yeah, that's in the sample mission that I put online. I have a little section which talks about how twists could happen or how setups could be part of it for that reason. So if you're the MC and you're thinking, okay, the game's over, all right, I'm done, and they're like, no, this was a setup, I'm like, ooh, okay. Because it is something that you should think about as the MC because it is an option on the player's move sheet right there at the end that they can choose.
Right, that does require, like any kind of Apocalypse World-based game, it requires the GM giving up some of their power to dictate what happens, which can be scary.
Yep. I usually find it's more fun than scary, though, as an MC. But that's, I mean, it's going to vary for people, and certainly I don't think... I mean, if you like that style of game, then the Sprawl does that. If you don't like that, then, yeah, the Sprawl probably is not the game for you.
Getting to the mission clocks, I thought that was, a unique and interesting part of the game, and I liked how the legwork countdown clock affected the mission clock. So maybe this is getting a little bit into the rules, but how do those tick down? Because they kind of made me think of Grim Portents from Dungeon World, where they tick down whenever the fictional events dictate that they do because, you know, the players made them come true, or they tick down kind of at the GM's choice as a hard move. So are mission and legwork clocks advanced the same way in the Sprawl?
They basically are, yeah, and it's basically the same system as countdown clocks, front clocks in Apocalypse World. So it's both prescriptive and descriptive. So either something in the fiction happens that causes this level to activate, or the GM makes a hard move and makes something happen in the fiction that makes that activate. That's probably one of the trickiest things about MCing the Sprawl, or one of the things that I imagine is the trickiest. I have been doing it for a while, so it's not really a problem for me now, but getting the sense of when you can advance those clocks and when you should advance those clocks to ratchet up the pressure on the players without just burning it all the way up to the top and then, oh, whoops, the game's over.
Right, because everybody's dead.
Yeah, and there's so much MC leeway in that. It really is about making hard moves. And the MC is going to have to decide for themselves and based on their group what kind of hard moves they make and what kind of positions they put their players in anyway.
Is that a response that some of the playtesters told you, that they found the clocks difficult to use?
No, it's just something that I worry about.
Okay, the reason I ask is because I actually thought that it was one of the better aspects of the game from when I was reading it, in that it seems that those clocks give a lot of assistance to the MC to decide what's going on, because there's a lot of different hard moves to choose from, so it can be tough to figure out which way to screw your players over. And I thought that the clocks were a really nice and really helpful aspect of the game. So.
Yeah, well, that's good. It's one of those aspects of the game that I, as the designer, worry about, but I haven't had any specific feedback. I guess there's the two kinds of things you hear back, right? You get the, I'm worried about this thing, and me as the designer is like, yeah, okay, that I kind of thought that people might have problems with that. Well, I can describe it better. Or I don't know how this works, and I'm like, what? Oh, all right, fine. Let me quickly scramble and look at that.
Cool.
With your playtest group, had any of the players come directly to the Sprawl as opposed to coming via Dungeon World or coming via Apocalypse World? Like, was this their first exposure to Powered by the Apocalypse?
Most of my playtesting has been one-off at conventions, and I think a few people have come to that, yeah. But I don't have any specific feedback on how that went for them. I'm not even sure what question I'd ask there. But nobody has had problems getting it at the table.
Right.
Even the people who have not played, who have not been exposed to Apocalypse World in any form.
Right.
I mean, I think Apocalypse World, I find that it's relatively easy to get, and I found that initially, and maybe that's just the way that I think and the way I think about games, but the way the moves say exactly what triggers the move and then exactly what happens makes it easy for me. Mm-hmm. If you're kind of looking for skill rolls or you're in that mindset, then maybe it's a bit trickier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure.
Well, you made a lot of use in or the beta of using like the different characters that they may have encountered in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
To set up certain playbooks that they could use and that. So I found that was really helpful. Mm-hmm. As probably the person that's least familiar with the Apocalypse World rule set. I hadn't played Dungeon World. That I found that really helpful just to get what was going on here. The fact that it is cyberpunk made it easier to get.
Right.
And the names that are used, like getting paid, get the job, things like that.
That's good. That's good to hear.
I guess one of the benefits that Lyle just mentioned of the sprawl is the fact that most people know what cyberpunk is, you know, or some version of it, either through Shadowrun or Cyberpunk 2020, or through, you know, reading William Gibson or things like that. So maybe people would have a better handle on what the game does and how the moves work because they have that grounding in what the game's genre is.
Mm-hmm. I feel like games that came after Apocalypse World have the advantage of having seen the problems that Apocalypse World has as far as being introduced to people goes, because it is quite open, and there's ways that you can prepare for that, or there's ways as a designer you can write the text to prepare people for that so that the MC knows, okay, this is the kind of thing that I have to do beforehand,
right,
that maybe aren't in Apocalypse World, or maybe they are. There's a bunch of things in Apocalypse World that I think, okay, I feel like you could have phrased this better, and I think some subsequent games have done that.
Hmm.
Developed on some of the technologies that Apocalypse World introduced to better help the GM and the players come to grips with the way that the game works.
I think that, again, that was either my experience or our experience, because it wasn't until reading Dungeon World and kind of having those fantasy tropes, you know, already in my mind that I finally figured out how the game should be run. And then going back and looking at Apocalypse World, I'm like, okay, I understand how to run this a lot better now, because right. I didn't have to sort of learn everything from the ground up.
The thing that really helped me with Apocalypse World, actually, was watching Deadwood. Because I watched that show, and I knew it was my Apocalypse World MC had said that this was one of the shows that he really liked. And as I watched it, I was like, wow, yeah, these show creators are just making hard moves all over the place. Oh, there's a tough choice. Oh, no. Okay, this is Apocalypse World. Wow. And, yeah, I don't know, Deadwood, I can't recommend it enough.
Well, you mentioned playbooks a moment ago, and actually, I thought the playbooks were awesome. They really speak right up of the genre, and the names and the kinds of moves that are available really got me into the game. For people who are listening, would you like to mention any of the specific playbooks that might get them more interested in the system? Or for that matter, do you have a favorite or one that's especially popular at the games you've run? Sorry, huge question.
Yeah. The most popular are the Killer, the Infiltrator, and the Hacker, mm-hmm. I think, which are also three of the earliest. The first four playbooks I made were the Hacker, the Driver, the Infiltrator, and the Killer. And they all kind of do what they say on the tin. The Killer uses bleeding edge technology to murder people. The Infiltrator sneaks into places and takes things. The Hacker does that virtual reality hacking stuff. And the Driver has a car and drones and is, yeah, that kind of character. So yeah, people love being ninjas. People love solid badasses. People love synth nerves. So Killer and Infiltrator are always really popular. Some people love hacking, some people don't. Mm-hmm. So that's up there. My favorite is the Soldier. Some people have trouble with the distinction between the Soldier and the Killer, just basically off the name. But I try and be explicit when I'm setting out the playbooks that the Soldier is more of a planner. It's more like, I'm blanking on the name of the guy from the A-Team.
Hannibal off of the A-Team.
Hannibal, yeah. Yeah, it is that. And you can tell that from the moves.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
The plan comes together. That's, yeah, straight out of the A-Team. That's my personal favorite because I like playing that kind of planning type character. Mm-hmm. And I like games that help me do that.
Yeah, I thought all of the different kinds of moves you put in there, each different playbook kind of spoke to a different style of player in addition to having kind of that genre trope built into it. But I'm wondering, some of the different playbooks had a bit of an overlap to them. Kind of the Soldier and the Fixer were there for setting up missions. The Hunter and the Reporter were both good at gathering kinds of information. And then some other ones like the Hacker and the Killer were pretty specialized. So I was wondering, with some of the playbooks that work well together and others that don't, is there kind of a good party size that you found to it? Is it better with more people or less people?
One of the great things about Apocalypse World and its derivatives for me is that you can really scale the party size down quite a lot. Like, I've played great two-player games of Dungeon World. One of my gaming fantasies, which I have yet to actually carry out, is to go to a convention and just run two-player games. Mm. Like, buddy cop games in a ton of different genres. Because, there's this one two-session, two-player with a druid and a ranger Dungeon World game I played. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I don't know, you just got to work out the relationship between the two players, between the two characters rather, so well over a long period. I usually run for four. I think four is the sweet spot I personally think four is the sweet spot for all games, actually. Mm-hmm. Because then everybody gets enough spotlight time.
Right.
And if somebody drops out, three players works as well for most games. Some really structured sort of balanced games like D&D, three might not work, mm-hmm. Or it might work in very particular cases. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the case with the sprawl, and with most Apocalypse World games, to be fair. I think you can make it work with two or three players, no matter what the playbooks are. Mm-hmm. If you have a game with a reporter and a fixer, it's just going to be a totally different game than if you have a game with a killer and an infiltrator. Mm-hmm. And the MC will have to be prepared and for that and give appropriate fictional challenges for the players. Mm-hmm. I often take up to five. If I know all of the players, I'll take five players in a game. But for five players, you have to be a bit more careful that nobody's getting left out. And I think four is the sweet spot, as I said.
Yeah, Wayne and I found the same thing. We played Monster Hearts a while back, and when we had only two players, it was a much more intimate game. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I totally agree with Apocalypse World being good with small groups. Mm-hmm. If you have a small group, is there any role that is kind of a must-have? The reason I ask is it's kind of difficult to imagine the mission-based game being run without a hacker. I think that could get quite a bit more difficult.
No, you could totally do it without a hacker. I've had many games without them. You can always hire, you can always outsource to NPCs.
Oh, okay, yes.
It's always fun. I do like the idea of, oh, yeah, we have this job to do. We need a hacker to get in to get the file, but we don't really have one, so we'll just hire this guy. Are we going to pay a lot to get somebody who's actually really good and isn't going to spend his entire time fishing around for information he can sell out on the side?
Nice.
Or are we just going to get some guy who can do the job and then we'll put up with the trouble that will cause?
Cool.
I was wondering, because part of the setup for the sprawl is that the characters are disposable. You know, the corpse will always be able to find someone like them, even if it's not them, and all the corpse kind of care about is getting the job done. So, like, I totally agree. Player-wise, yeah, four people, and, you know, maybe something of, niche protection, so that people aren't stepping on each other's toes during the game. But in terms of overlap, I'm wondering if, you know, kind of overlapping roles to an extent plays into that fact that there are other people like you and you're disposable, as opposed to other Apocalypse World-based games where, you know, you're the mage or you're the, you know, battle babe or you're the whatever because you're special.
Yeah, one of the things with overlapping characters, I think if you had two characters like the reporter and the hunter, say, who overlap in a lot of ways, the game would end up focusing on the ways that they didn't overlap. And the game would basically be, the default would be about the ways they do. So if you're a hunter and a reporter, maybe every mission is about finding people. Hmm. But then the ways that the characters make themselves distinct will be those things that each has that the other doesn't. So like the kind of more bounty hunter angle of the hunter or the more like story angle of the reporter. And there's a lot of choice in optional moves. So the characters are reasonably customizable, more so than Apocalypse World, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Agreed, yeah.
Moves to choose from. So you're not so pigeonholed. Not that I think Apocalypse World pigeonholes you, but Dungeon World certainly, if you're a fighter, yeah, you get to decide what it is.
Yeah, true.
Right. And that's cool. Like, I always play fighters in Dungeon World because, you know, I that weapon thing is cool. But you don't really have any choice until you start leveling up. Whereas, you could make, and I have a section in this, I've never had it in a game where I had two players with the same playbook, but I could see two reporters, say, taking quite different moves and still working together.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. The killer was really variable. You could make kind of the cybered up ninja character or kind of the big burly bouncer kind of guy. Yeah, I thought there's a lot of variance in the playbooks. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, especially the killer, actually, because chromed, the move that gets you cyberware is one of the core moves. Mm-hmm. That automatically is going to split you up.
Yeah.
Differentiate you from any other killer. I have a list of how many times different playbooks have been played that I think kind of compiled for my interest to see if there was something that nobody was ever playing and was like, okay, so what's the problem with this class? Mm-hmm. But I don't have one that specifies what cyberware each killer took, but there's a lot of variation.
I bet. One of the playbooks, I didn't really understand purpose, or maybe they didn't understand the focus of it so much, was the pusher. They didn't seem to really fit into the kind of mission hierarchy that you have laid out in the game. Could you tell us a little bit more about that playbook?
Yeah, so the pusher, it's not so immediately clear how it works in the mission structure, but it's a playbook that comes about from several character types that exist in various other cyberpunk games, mm-hmm. like the Rocker or the Corporate. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a distillation of that kind of character where you've got some ideology that you're pushing. You've got some cause, some vision, whether it's you want to be like the rock star and you're trying to change the world to rock and roll, mm-hmm. or with your corporate guy who's all out for money. One of the more interesting ones I had was
it reminded me of a cult leader, at least one of the things that you can do with it. And it reminded me of that Apocalypse World playbook.
Oh, the Hocus.
Yeah, the Hocus, which is what I played when I played Apocalypse World.
Yeah, it definitely has a lot in common, and there's some moves that are derived from that. Mm-hmm. An open source software hacktivist, that was the one I was trying to
remember. Oh, cool.
And he basically had a whole lot of his believers were all like open source activists, and he was getting them to do denial of service attacks on people. He organized a flash mob as a distraction at one point.
That's so cool.
Yeah, and his ideology was information should be free. And so he was trying to do that. So it's quite an open one, actually. It's probably one of the most open playbooks in the game, actually, because you can take it in a bunch of different directions.
Awesome. I now want to play that. That sounds great.
Yeah, it gets a lot of play, actually, and in some quite interesting ways. It's one of the playbooks that if somebody picks it, I'm like, oh, yeah, here we go.
The game's on.
Yeah, cool. Which I love as an MC.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, yeah, this is kind of all three of us came to this question at one point. One of the common criticisms of specifically the old Cyberpunk 2020 game, but I'm sure Shadowrun had it as well, was kind of the lonesome hacker, where they would go off and do their own hacking mission separate from the other players. It would be split from the group. How does that fit into this game?
So that's another reason why Apocalypse World as a base works for me for Cyberpunk, because the way that Powered by the Apocalypse game's structure, gameplay as a conversation means that it's really easy to switch focus back and forth between different scenes. Hmm. And certainly in my experience of Apocalypse World, most of the time, every player, like the party is split totally.
Yes.
And that's a problem it's a feature of all modern games, really. As soon as you introduce cell phones, okay, we don't need to hang out together. I can go research this thing, I can go research this thing, and we can get into trouble in separate locations. Mm-hmm. And generally the system handles that pretty well, the way that you can switch back and forth between players. I have some explicit advice in the Kickstarter version 3. I'm not sure if any of you read that one, where I give advice both on managing spotlight time without a hacker and explicitly with a hacker, because that is a problem that it's probably the most commonly cited problem with Cyberpunk games, mm-hmm. that, yeah, we get somewhere and then the hacker goes off and does his game and we all sit around and talk about sports or something.
Right.
And I actually, in the last game I ran of it, I ran into this problem, which caused me to write some new advice about mission building, where I'd accidentally structured an adventure so that they had to get the hacker in somewhere and then do something, and I didn't. And then it ended up with a little bit of a hacker minigame. It wasn't too bad because interesting things were happening for the hacker, but it was a bit of a trap that I fell into. Mm-hmm. So that caused some a couple of rewrites in the advice how not to back yourself into this corner in a mission.
Cool.
Yeah.
So did that experience cause you to rewrite any tools or mechanics, or did the framework of the bouncing back and between conversations made easy by the Apocalypse World, was that kind of all you have in there, and the experience caused you to rewrite advice?
Yeah, that experience caused me to rewrite advice. There were some other things that changed as a result of that playtest, but they weren't related to that.
Right.
There were some other things about Matrix, the way that Matrix moves work, and the way that there were a couple of other things that switched around as a result of those games. This was playtest strategic on over the weekend.
I quite like the driver, and I think if a lot of people hear that, they just think the person sits in their car, doesn't matter how enhanced it is. But then you've also incorporated the drones. Did that come about because of playtesting, to give the driver more to do outside of the car?
That kind of came about. I'd played a driver in Apocalypse World, mm-hmm. and so I knew how tricky it was. It took us a while. I think we played about 9 sessions or so. It took about 5 or 6 sessions before we worked out, oh, wait, the key to the driver is that everybody wants the car. Mm. So we just have to focus that. It's not about the guy being cool with the car. It's about everybody wanting the car and wanting him to do things with the car. Mm. That's Apocalypse World. That kind of works a little in the sprawl, but not so much. But the way that drones had been introduced in various other games, and drones are a big thing, like, in pop culture now anyway in the world. So it's a natural kind of thing to introduce. That really helps make the driver be able to be everywhere and be able to contribute in any way they want, really. But that wasn't as a result of playtesting so much as just me thinking about the problems of playing a driver from my experience playing a driver in a different version of Apocalypse World, and thinking about, you know, those common problems with Cyberpunk games where, yeah, okay, the driver is sitting outside in his car waiting for the team to come out so he can engage in that chase scene at the end.
Yeah.
Right.
And the driver is another playbook where I try to give specific advice in the playbook discussion about what the kinds of things you might want to think about if you're considering playing a driver, and if you're running a game in which there is a driver.
Right.
Did the drones take any inspiration from Shadowrun with the Rigger character?
Oh, that's what I was thinking too.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I love playing a Rigger before, so awesome.
I played a few Riggers as well in my teenage years. Cars, right? And yeah, drones are fun.
Exactly.
Drones with guns, tiny little drones. One of the missions over the weekend that I ran, they didn't have a driver, but they used their contacts to get in touch with a drone operator guy, and then we're just sending crazy drone swarms in at this corporate archaeology to work out where his defenses were. And awesome. The guy's price was, he was just ratcheting up. He was like, no, okay, this is going to cost you a little bit more now if you're starting to send in these drones, or you've used up too many drones. It was a fun little part of the game.
Awesome. Actually, speaking of the driver too, one of the things I really liked was the vehicle construction system. It was nice that the rules are pretty simple, but they also got pretty involved as to how you could construct your vehicle.
Yeah, that's very much, I can't really claim too much of that is my own inspiration, really, because so much of that is kind of straight out of Apocalypse World, with obvious tweaks to get a cyberpunk world. But the system, having played a driver in Apocalypse World, I knew the system kind of worked. And I think it's very much relies on that as its base. So thanks, Vincent.
Well, actually, going on with that, with some of the gear and the equipment involved, for me personally, I've toyed with playing a cyberpunk game in Apocalypse World before, but I never got to the conceptual stage. But one of the stumbling blocks was the gear, because we were talking about image and style before. I think the gear and weapons that your character carry is a really big part of cyberpunk, but Apocalypse World has very light rules when it comes to gear. You know, it's usually only like damage 1, damage 2. Kind of things. So I think you had a pretty good way of getting around that with the lists and the tags for it. You want to say anything about that for people listening? Because it's a really interesting system.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extension of what is in Apocalypse World anyway. I don't think I've really added very much new in that sense, except for the specifics of what the kind of tags are. But I definitely draw from Tech Noir as well. If you want to see how tags are done really well to make... I mean, every piece of equipment in Tech Noir, you list off a series of tags, and that's kind of defines it. I haven't gone quite that far. I didn't really feel like it ever was necessary to go that far. But there certainly is that element of sort of techno-fetishism about cyberpunk, and it comes across in the cyberware, and that's why cyberware has a special chapter. But then weapons are often a big part of it as well. And that's why, I guess, the kind of weapons section is large, and then the rest of the gear is relatively abstract.
Mm-hmm.
But I generally, as with so many things in Powered by the Apocalypse, it's really about fictional positioning, so I don't need to give you rules for how a communicator works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, phone works. You can imagine that. You can interact. You can extrapolate anything that your smartphone can do now to what it might do 50 years in the future. Mm-hmm. You don't need to tell me this gives you a plus one to this or minus one to this or blah, blah, blah. That's all stuff that it kind of works at the, I want to say the speed of plot.
nice.
Like getting around in the Whedonverse, right? In the world of Firefly. Now, those orbital mechanics don't make sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
You just get from planet to planet at whatever speed the plot requires.
Exactly.
That narrative element of gear is something that I tried to just leave in there for individual groups to do on their own.
Nice. I think it succeeded very well, especially with the cyberware as well. The tags on that worked really well. And actually, as you mentioned before about how the cyberware, how you made choosing the cyberware an important choice was nice. I thought it kind of harkened back to the old Artelsarian Cyberpunk 2020 game. I noticed in the harm section that one of the choices is to lose a limb or an organ. It's kind of pushing you towards the more cyber gear for that. So.
It's the thing, like, some of those options seem really harsh. Like, wow, I could lose an eye or lose a limb. But then it's like, that's only a cyberware. It's only a cyberware implant away. You just have to make a deal with a corporation and you're fully functional again. So what's the problem with that?
Exactly.
Right.
And then this starts to become like, oh, I could lose an eye. That's awesome.
I had someone lose an eye over the weekend, actually. They listened and they're like, yeah, okay. And then they started playing the rest of the game with one eye shut.
Awesome.
The Kickstarter is running now. We were closing in on the first stretch goal when the interview started, and I kind of had this thought that maybe it might kick over during.
That would be so sweet.
It's really close, or it's close, yeah.
It is. Yeah, it's $800 away from the first stretch goal. So basically the levels of the Kickstarter, everything is digital. You back at any level and you get access to the latest playtest draft. Is one of the things I really like about Kickstarter is the kind of community that it fosters. And one of the things that has been important to me about the development of the Sprawl is the open playtesting that I've had, particularly on Barforth Apocalyptica. And all sorts of people from all around the world have contributed really interesting and provocative things that have affected the game in various ways. So if you back at the basic level, just $1 in New Zealand, you can download the game and check it out, see whether you like it. If you don't like it, cancel your pledge, whatever. And if you do like it, contribute, tell me what you like, what you don't like, and so on. Then above that, there's levels that give you a PDF of the game when it's finished. There'll be two PDFs. There'll be one that's full color for use on a tablet and one that's designed with minimal ink for printing out. I'm not doing an offset print run. All of the print levels give you access to buy an at-cost version from DriveThruRPG, which should result in the total price to get a print copy of about $30 US. That's my kind of estimate based on how much print-on-demand costs. There are levels where you can get audio files from Wes Otis at Playmail Games, who's run three successful Kickstarters to do these 10-minute background loops of various sound effects, and he's a professional sound editor, so they're really good. I've used them in a couple of games myself.
You're using them on the video. It's a really good background.
Yeah, one called Inside the Internet, which worked really well with the driving scene at the start. Actually, I quite like the way that came out. So he has these background loops; they're really good, and you can get some of those at the audio level, five of those at the moment. And then there are some driver levels above that, where I'll come to a convention. I think there are some Gen Con slots left, but all the local ones, local to me, California ones, are gone now. I might open up more, and I'm open to more if you have some convention in, I don't know, Portland or Nebraska or something.
Right, so Kansai doesn't count.
Yeah.
If you hit Osaka, though, just look us up.
I don't even know how much that would cost.
Japan is the inspiration for cyberpunk. You got
to
make it.
It's true. It would be pretty awesome to run a game in Japan, I have to say. I've never been to Japan, but that would be pretty cool. If I am ever in Japan, I will totally run a game.
Sweet.
So I'll let you guys know. So the first stretch goal is a set of missions, 10 at the moment, which are missions that I've run previously. I know that they work and they're playtested, and I will develop them into fully playable missions in the style of the Kurosawa Extraction, which is up on my blog at the moment, and there's a link from the Kickstarter page to that. And there will be, by the time this comes out, the next stretch goal should be active, and that will most likely be a Shadowrun-esque, magic-y, cyberpunk setting that a friend of mine is going to write. There's a few other potential, like, setting flavor packages that are other things that I'm going to roll out as the Kickstarter develops, if it funds well enough.
Yeah, those setting packages sound pretty cool because, yeah, as it stands now, the sprawl could be anywhere, which, you know, is great because then you can say, hey, this, you know, we're playing the game right here in whatever city you happen to be in. But, yeah, I would love to see some, setting packs where, you know, you actually take a location and then say, this is what's going on. You mentioned tech noir before, and I kind of imagined them a little bit like the transmission booklets, although perhaps not the random rolls to generate what's going on, but... Yeah, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, I'm imagining something like 3 to 4 page write-ups, well, maybe a bit more than that, of just condensed evocative material for a particular kind of setting or kind of twist on cyberpunk, whether it's to make it kind of an more orbital focus or more horror focus, this kind of thing. Yeah, or kind of individual setting places as well. Like, I have this continuing idea in my head after a conversation with Mike Sands, who the writer of Monster of the Week, about a setting either in Vladivostok or in the Balkans, where it's all about these really low-flying planes and the Russian steppe, like, doing missions against corporate bases out there. And it kind of expands on the urban focus of the sprawl a little bit, but if the core of the game is still urban, then I'm pretty happy.
Cool. Yeah. Huh, that might be sweet. Well, looking at this, yeah, I just refreshed my page, and I'm pretty sure you might have a picture of the three of us for a chapter header.
Awesome. Yeah, that's right. I opened up some new those new levels over the weekend as well.
Yeah,
one thing I discovered about Kickstarter was that Monday is a really slow day for Kickstarters. I was watching it yesterday, and most of the days I've kind of... There's been, you know, about $800 or so a day, except for the first day, which was crazy. Then yesterday it was only $200. It's like, it's like one of those moments you have as a Kickstarter runner. Every little, if you're watching it obsessively, every little blip, you think, oh no,
what's going to happen?
Overanalyze everything. Right. It's a fun process, I've got to say, running a Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm. This isn't your first one, hey?
I did it with, Conquering Corsair is a board game that I wrote with a friend of mine, but he was the one who was actually running it from his account, so I didn't have access to all the daily information. I just had whatever he was telling me. But actually having this graph on my phone means that I can just be obsessively updating it.
It's going to be nerve-wracking.
Yeah. It does keep me thinking about different ways I can update.
Have there been any places that you kind of advertised to that really boosted your numbers, like any cyberpunk communities or something like that?
There's a Twitter account, Cyberpunk Reddit, that has been retweeting my stuff like crazy, which is cool.
Cool.
But mostly the communities that I've advertised in gaming communities, RPG Net, Story Games. I have the forum on Fourth Apocalyptica. And then it's mostly been Twitter. Oh, and Google Plus.
Okay.
Right.
And I think that's pretty much reflected in the stats about where people are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I should look around for some Google Plus communities on Cyberpunk, actually. I bet there's some.
So your campaign runs until October 4th, so there's still plenty of time from the time this goes live to get in.
Yeah, as of recording, we're only 6 days in, and it's almost 400% funded. So, I didn't expect it to go to completely fund within 3 hours. I launched it, and then I went into I teach at a university, so I went into class. And when I came out of class, it was funded.
So I guess... You needed to think of those stretch goals.
Yeah. And I hadn't, I thought of the stretch goals at that point, but I didn't have them all specifically planned out because I kind of wanted to see how it went. There's no point putting up a thing that lists all your stretch goals coming before $10,000 and you blow through that in the first day and it's like, wow, okay, what have I done? To pace them with to account for the success of the campaign. So
yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah, so it's going pretty well. So go to the Kickstarter, look at the video. I'm sorry that I never say geek during the video. I don't talk about cyber geeks at all.
we'll throw a couple you. In here.
And if you like what you see, back it.
Please do. We have, so.
Yeah. Thank no you. Excuse not to now.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Well, that wraps up our interview with Hamish Cameron, the creator of The Sprawl, a cyberpunk game powered by the apocalypse. And it's not a happy cyberpunk game.
Are there happy cyberpunk games?
I guess we'll just never see one.
Thank you very much, Hamish. It's great talking to you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time. Bye.
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 Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
IdleRedHands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.